Welcome to Rink Talk. I'm Robert McLemon. In today's episode, I'm going to be interviewing three different individuals whose families have gone through really challenging circumstances in recent years. And as you're about to hear, backyard rinks have played an important role in helping those families get through them. Stay tuned. You were just listening to some beautiful music composed especially for the podcast by Keenan Reimer Watts and performed by Clarissa Webb. You'll be hearing more from them later in the episode. We're calling today's episode Rinks of Hope, and I think by the end of it you'll understand why. I've had the honor in recent weeks of interviewing three individuals, all of them fathers, whose families have been going through challenges that I think it's safe to say very few of the rest of us could really understand. I've asked each of them to come on the podcast because a backyard rink has played an important role in the lives of their family and in trying to get through the situations that each of them face. My first interview is with Chris Jackson of Fort McMurray, Alberta. The name Fort McMurray is synonymous with the devastating wildfire that swept through the city in the spring of 2016, destroying homes and livelihoods, including Chris Jackson's. Chris first came to my attention through his participation in Rink Watch, a citizen science project I co-direct, where we ask backyard rink makers from across North America to share skating conditions with us so we can help track variations in winter climate. In the winter of 2015-2016, Chris had the first skating rink anywhere in North America to report good skating conditions. He also won the Golden Hoser Award from retailer Canadian Tire, which was recognizing impressive backyard rinks across the country that winter. Literally days after the skating season ended, Chris's home and backyard rink were destroyed in the wildfire that swept through Fort McMurray. Here is my interview with Chris about what went down that spring and how he and his family hope to get back on the ice real soon. Hey Chris, welcome to the podcast. Let's start with a simple question. A lot of our listeners may never have been to Fort McMurray and may not know much about it. Could you tell us a little bit about what life's like up there?
Well, Robert, I know if people don't know where Fort McMurray is, we're pretty far northern Alberta. So I like to tell people, especially when I'm down in the United States, that you know where Santa Claus lives? We're just a bit south of that. That's not totally accurate, but it gives you an idea how far north we actually are. I know that the summers are gorgeous up here, but they're very short. They probably run from about middle of May or June when it gets to be nice, and then it gets to September, even the end of August, we start having the leaves turn colors on the trees and start getting into the fall mode. But in the summers, we get tons of daylight. Obviously being so far north, we get the sun doesn't set till after midnight, and then it starts getting light again 3 o'clock in the morning. But then on the flip side, the winters are pretty dark, they're pretty cold, and they're pretty long, so a lot of times we have snow on the ground by Halloween, and it doesn't go away until better part of April most times. So yeah, it can be a bit of a challenge for people that aren't they're not liking the winters or the cold or whatever. I know we have a lot of people up here that are from different countries and different nationalities, and it's always a big adjustment to the climate and up here.
And so, what do people do for a living up there?
Yeah, so we're an oil sands town, so a lot of the employment, it's driven by the industry. We have a number of large players here up in the region, so that's where a lot of people come for the work, and then obviously there's the supporting industries and the service industry that goes along with that. So the biggest draw here is the work, and the people come for that. The part of Fort McMurray is, I wouldn't say we're an isolated town, but, I mean, you think about it, we're about 5 hours north of Edmonton. So that's the closest major city. So if the challenge is if you ever wanted to go out and do anything, you're quite a ways away before you actually hit the big city and get back into civilization, sometimes people call that.
But you're not one of these people who's moved from the south to Fort McMurray, are you?
So I was actually born in the Yukon, and even farther north, and I'm probably one of the few people that can say I moved south to go to Fort McMurray. But we moved down here when I was four, just turning five, and my dad was taking a job at one of the oil sands plants that was starting up, and that was 40 years ago. So this winter will be my 40th winter in Fort McMurray.
Chris, you became famous a couple of years ago for your backyard rink. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Yeah, so that's going back a couple of years ago. You know, I started building rinks even a couple of years prior to that, more so just for my young son. I think so 2 years ago he would have been five, but he was really had a passion for hockey. He's a kind of an athlete at heart. We had built a bunch of smaller rinks the previous years, and so he's always outside. He likes the sports. He likes being on the ice. He's been skating since he's probably 3 years old. So I decided to go a little bit more elaborate with a rink that year, and it started out. I actually had won a contest on social media from Nice Rink with a basic rink package with a liner and the board supports, and it kind of took off from there that I started going a little bit more elaborate and decided, well, I'd do something different and put some lights in the ice. So I experimented with LED lights underneath the ice, and the conditions are pretty much ideal up here in the north for putting an ice rink in outdoors, just having a long, cold winters. So we do have that long time I mentioned about having the right conditions for skating. So I believe I started probably mid-October. I had a landscaper come in because I had to level out the backyard a little bit, and I decided to go make my rink bigger than I've ever done before. And the biggest size I could put in was 20 feet by 30 feet, and that was right from fence to the edge of my garage. So, but that was a pretty decent size, especially for a five-year-old that's skating. The rink probably seemed pretty big for him. Come November 27th of that year, it was solid. I can remember the day vividly. It was a nice sunny day, blue sky. It wasn't really cold because I remember Luke was out in his long-sleeve T-shirt, and he was anxious to get on the ice because he saw all the work we put into it. And he really wanted to get out there. So back then, he was probably about 30 pounds. So he was my guinea pig. I said, you go walk out on the ice and see if it's strong enough. And so I put him out there, and he went out there, slid on his shoes, and it was perfect. So he wanted to get his skates on. And, yeah, I think if you go back to my social media and pictures I sent to Rink Watch and made it known to the world that November 27th, we were skating on our backyard rink in Fort McMurray, and that was, as you mentioned, probably the first one in Canada that year. The rink got a lot of attention. Social media plays a big, big factor in that. So we're always posting pictures. And I'd kind of done the rink up fairly nice with, like I said, getting a little bit elaborate, got carried away. I put some logos on the side of the rink boards, and we'd have lots of skating parties, and people took a big interest in it. But I was nominated for the Canadian Tire the Golden Hoser Award. It was a kind of a surprise, but it was really cool, and even got more attention than obviously media picking that up, and I did some interviews on CBC. But it was really cool to share the story with other people and other rink builders across North America even.
And was that a good winter for skating?
So that was actually. We didn't have a whole lot of snow for the first half of the winter. We probably got the bulk of our snow end of February, March, but it was great rink conditions. I can remember I spent a lot of time in the rink. I always made sure that the ice was perfect. It was always shoveled off for whoever wanted to come skating or if we were always out. I mean, I think 6 days out of the week, we were out in the backyard skating and playing hockey or whatever and having fun. But the last skating day that we had was probably the middle of April that year. And that's when half the rink was a little bit slushy, but I think I got pictures of Luke still out on the skates on half the ice. So November 27th to mid-April, that's pretty
nearly
long season.
5 months. Yeah.
I know. So yeah, it was a good time. It was a good year for skating rinks for sure.
That was a spectacular winter for skating, but everything changed that April, didn't it?
Yeah, there was a pretty big event that happened up here last year. So I had there was a bit of a forest fire that had started around the community, and I remember it quite vividly on the end of May, waking up and going to work, or sorry, the end of April, beginning of May, waking up, going to work, blue sky, it was nice and calm. Actually, the night before, I had decided that most of the ice was all melted in the rink, and I decided to let the sideboards down. I let all the water out of the rink, washed down in the back alley and whatnot, and then went to work the next day, and I never did return back to my house, never returned back to the rink to take it all down, because that's when the great forest fire, the wildfire, went through our city. And our neighborhood was one of the first ones that got touched by the fire, and it destroyed a large portion of our neighborhood, my house included, the home that I had spent 35 years in growing up, and it totally wiped out and devastated everything.
A lot of the people listening, myself included, would have a hard time imagining what that must be like to go off to work one day and to never come home, to be told, you can't go home, it's too dangerous. Can you tell us what that does to a community?
The saving grace is that a community of over 80,000 people, and I'm sure a lot of people have seen, heard the stories, or maybe they followed it last year, but 80,000 people evacuated the city, and there wasn't a single life lost due to the wildfire. Sure, there was a lot of structures damaged, there was homes damaged, lives changed for a lot of people that day. And we were so fortunate that, you know, I didn't have to go through the evacuation that way. My job is farther north, and I end up having to get flown out to Edmonton to a evac center. But I didn't have to go through and see my city on fire or see my neighborhood on fire. My family was already down in Edmonton at the time, so luckily they didn't have to go through that as well, because I think that would have left a lasting impression. But, you know, it's devastating even coming back a couple months later. We managed to come back in by the middle of June, our first time back in McMurray, just to see what happened. And it's heartbreaking. It's gut-wrenching. And it's hard to put that into words to describe it. But to go from thinking life was great and everything was awesome, and then all of a sudden it changes in the blink of an eye. Everything that you know is gone. Everything that you've had is lost. So
you lost your home, your possessions, your rink, it's all gone?
It's all gone, yeah. There was nothing salvageable. The fire was pretty brutal. It's weird because the fire picked and chose where it wanted to go, and there's actually a couple houses on my street that weren't even touched. And then there's other ones that were totally wiped out. So I went back and looked, and even there was nothing. There was some melted plastic of the board supports that we had, and that was about it. I mean, nothing was recognizable. It totally changed the landscape of the area. So, I didn't have to go and pack up all the liner and the boards and all that. It was all taken care of for me.
Unlike yourself, there was a large number of people who never came back.
There was. So there's not a for sure number of how many people left. There's an estimate, because not only the fire, just the economy up here was on a downturn. A lot of people were struggling, so the fire may have been used as another means, another reason to move on. But there's probably somewhere between 15 to 20, 25% people have not returned back to McMurray. So we're talking now, this has happened last year. So we've seen a noticeable change. Things are starting to come back. People are finding a new normal. They're finding new routines. Obviously, people like myself that have lost a house, people are rebuilding. They're getting reestablished in a neighborhood, or they decided to buy somewhere else. And it really changes your perspective on life and your outlook. Priorities change. And the community has really rallied together, though, and come back stronger. And, you know, there's not a lot of talk about it anymore. At first, there was a lot of talk about we all had that in common. Everyone had the fire and the evacuation in common. But it's still going to take a number of years to recover and move on. But like I said, the city's been resilient. There's always been the slogan about staying resilient, staying strong, and definitely that really brought the community together. And it really showed this year now with the fires that happened in BC. The community was one of the first communities that stepped up to support them down there, because we know firsthand what it's like to go through that. So it's really cool to see. It was almost like a reunion of sorts. I think people coming together to help others out in the same situation.
So what are your long-term plans?
So right now we are, you know, the last year we've been kind of renting and staying in a number of different places. Currently we're renting a house down in another part of the city. And we're pretty comfortable there right now. We haven't made any decisions on what we're going to do. Eventually, I think we'd like to rebuild. We're in a couple of different circumstances, so it makes it a little bit more difficult for us. So we're just trying to find the right path and know the right timing for it to get back there. I've heard some stories of people that have rebuilt, moved back into the same neighborhood, and then weeks or a month later they decided to move out because they just couldn't handle it. I think just knowing that the neighborhood's not going to be the same people aren't going to be there. I know people were really anxious to get back to the same routine and the same way of life and the lifestyle they had before the fire, but that's not going to happen, and I think we've accepted that. We know it's going to be different. So it could be a bit of a psychological slash mental challenge going back to the same area. Even just driving through right now and looking at the rebuild, you get mixed emotions, and it's easy to think back to the way things were and why did this have to happen. But, you know, we can't change the past. We're going to move on. And, you know, the second question you had about rebuilding rinks, it's still a passion. It's still, like I said, once it comes to rink building season, you get the group of people on the different forums and the support sites, and I know it was really cool last year. I was starting to help out other people, and I've encouraged people in just from my rink that I had, was it 2 years ago, last year, that there's a number of people that I knew up here that wanted to build the rink. So I was almost a rink advisor, I guess, and people are coming to me with suggestions or questions and issues, and I'd help them out. I even went so far as actually trying to build another rink last year in my friend's yard. We were really gung-ho about it because that was the number one question people kept asking. Chris, are you going to rebuild the rink? Are you going to do another rink? And they knew that I wasn't in my house, I was somewhere else. And at first I said no, I wasn't, but then the opportunity came up to help another person. And we started to do it. We had some pretty grand plans, and then it just kind of fell off the rails. It was really hard when you're not living in the spot where you're building your backyard rink. It's hard to get to, and we were on the other side of town, and, you know, after working all day and it's dark out and cold, the last thing in your mind is thinking about driving across town and dragging a hose out and trying to maintain the rink. But so we didn't get very far with that. The place we are now, though, it does have a fairly nice sized backyard, and it's probably a good possibility that I'll put something in. I know Luke is still interested in skating. He still wants to stay active and stay fit, and he's asking about a rink too. So there's a good chance with the material that I had bought last year, so we have all that. And I think the conditions are right, and the way things go, we could probably see more rinks down the road for sure.
Well, we're going to keep our fingers crossed for you so that everything comes together this winter so you can have another rink.
Well, you know what? I think the 40 winters I've been up here, I can remember pretty much every one of them has been cold enough. So I don't think the cold weather is going to be a factor.
You know, Chris, listening to your story, it's a good reminder to all of us that we should not take for granted, you know, the good things that we have in life, and that, you know, we need to cherish those things that we have in terms of our family and the activities that we love to do with them.
No, absolutely. Like I mentioned before, after the fire, it really changes people's perspective, and you take for granted maybe what we have or don't have. And, you just really, you cherish family, you cherish the time a little bit more. And for us, I mean, like I said, we can't change the past, and the stuff that was lost, really, it's just stuff. And there's a lot of memorable stuff, and there's a lot of, antiques from my family and all that, but the important thing is the family is safe and we're together. We're staying strong and getting through it. And, you know, we learn from that. We grow from that. I think it makes us stronger. And you're absolutely right. You know, I found when I was building the rinks that coming home from work, no matter how bad the day was at work, getting out on the rink and spending an hour or whatever, resurfacing it and skating, it's therapeutic. And you hear that from a lot of rink builders that they take a lot of pride and passion into what they do. And, it's encouraging to be able to get out there and, you know, spend time with family, with friends, just skating. It's a great activity. And embrace the cold north and or wherever you may be.
Chris, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
No worries. Thank you again, Robert.
That was Chris Jackson. I reached him by telephone at his home in Fort McMurray, Alberta. Thank you. My next guest on the podcast is well known throughout the internet community that's interested in outdoor skating. His backyard rink in Portugal Cove, Newfoundland has its own website, Reason for the Rink, and visitors have been coming for years to gawk at the NHL caliber ice surface that Todd Churchill has built in his backyard. As you're about to hear in my interview with Todd, he built it not simply as a vanity project, but with the explicit intention of using it to raise money and awareness for children's charities. Here's an interview I recorded with Todd earlier this year. Todd, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, nice to be here.
Listen, I think the first thing we need to do is we've got a photo of your rink up on the website for the podcast, but for those who are just listening to this, could you describe your fantastic rink for us?
My rink is 94 by 46 in terms of dimensions. I have full-size boards, same as NHL boards. I have lines, logos, face-off circles, creases, in-ice logos, everything roughly to scale. So roughly my rink is the quarter size of an NHL-sized rink. I live stream events during the winter through a live feed on my website, reasonfortherink.com. Throughout the winter, I do a number of charity events to raise money for different charities that I support.
And how long have you been at this? Before we get into the details of the charities and so on, how long have you been at building this rink?
I've done it 5 years. So far, I started back in 2012 when I built it. I started building it in June of 2012, and I finished in November of 2012. So it took me a number of months to build it. There's 28 straight sections of boards and four corners. Corners took quite a long time to figure out because, of course, you can't buy curved lumber. So it took me a while to figure out how to make round corners because I felt that was really important. If you're going to make a rink, then you want to go all the way and you don't want square corners. You want to have round corners. So it took me a while to figure that one out, but eventually I mastered it. But I do hate my corners because they're difficult to place. They're heavy and they're just difficult all around, but they look nice.
And so now that you've been at it for a few years, how long start to finish does it take to establish the rink and get it all flooded once winter rolls along?
Usually I start in around the middle of October. I have to reach out to all my sponsors. And the first thing I have to do is get all my board ad sponsors committed because all my boards are stored indoors in my detached garage. So if I have to change any of the logos, say a sponsor doesn't come back and I have to get a new sponsor, then the logo has to be removed from last year. A new one has to be put on. And that has to be done indoors. The first step is to get the sponsors lined up. And once I get all my logos straightened out and replaced as needed and I get paint touch-ups done, then I move the boards outside about mid-November. And then I try to target by end of November, early December, having the boards erected. And then toward the middle of December, I try to flood.
And do you have a tarp that you use on this rink? I mean, it must be one heck of a big tarp. And if so, are there some logistical challenges to getting it all sort of flooded and organized?
Yeah, absolutely. I use a liner. I use a liner from Center Ice Rinks. They're located in Mississauga. They're very nice people. And I get a new liner every year because it's so hard to reuse a liner because the liner I buy is 50 by 100, and I have to cut it down to 94 by 46. So I purposely made the rink that size to give me some slack on each side to allow misalignment of the liner. So I always have a little bit of slack I have to trim. So yeah, it's quite a big piece of plastic. And I said to somebody the other day on Facebook that we were discussing about liners and things. And I said, you have to treat your liner like it's glass because you don't want to walk on your liner. You don't want to drop something on it because I've torn my liner in the past and it happens so quickly. You just have a lapse of concentration. You go to pull a wrinkle out while you're flooding and you put your hands right through the thing. And that's actually happened to me before.
And do you just simply, you know, put the liner down and just start flooding it? Or is there a sort of technique to making a rink surface that big?
No, there's definitely a technique. My very first year I did it, I actually stretched out the entire piece of plastic and ran it up the boards, trimmed, put all my kickboards around before I started flooding, which was totally the wrong way to do it. The best way to do it is to identify the low point of your yard so that you'll know what part of your rink will start to flood first. Then what you want to do is unroll the liner that in that part of your rink. And then as the water progressively moves up your rink, unroll more of your liner. so that you never have very much of your liner exposed. And this is really important if you're in a place like Newfoundland where you get a lot of wind, because you don't want your liner exposed to some wind gusts that come up and suddenly your liner could get torn. So you want to minimize your vulnerability to wind by doing it that way.
That makes a lot of sense, especially when you're dealing with such a huge rink. I mean, most people are probably building rinks, you know, a quarter or an eighth the size of the one that you're building.
Yeah, it's definitely challenging. It takes about 3 days to flood my rink. About 2 years ago, I had a problem with my well, and my well actually went dry a number of times when I was flooding this thing, and I had to reset my pump maybe 40 times over the space of about 3 days. So I think I started flooding like one day before Christmas Eve, and I turned off the pumps or the water about 11 o'clock Christmas night. So it takes a long time to flood it, but it's a relief once it's flooded. Your next vulnerable time then is the period until you get enough ice to be able to stand on it, because your big nightmare as a rinker is if you get a little skim of ice that's just enough to hold snow but not enough to hold you.
Now that we've sort of talked about the logistics of building such a big rink, let's talk to the reasons why you go through all this effort in the first place. What you called your website that you have for your rink, the reasons for the rink. Could you tell the podcast listeners what are the reasons?
The reason for the rink is actually my son Carter. He was born in 2011, and when Carter was born, he was he had quite a tumultuous entry into the world, and he spent the first month of his life in the neonatal intensive care unit at the Janeway Hospital in St. John's. And for the first week in particular, it was very scary. We didn't know if he was going to actually live or not. It was that grave. And he fought through all those battles, and eventually he came home. But unfortunately, he was later diagnosed as being deaf and with cerebral palsy, which were complications from all the other issues he had at birth. So I said to numerous people, like, it's hard to describe being a parent of a child like Carter. It's so heart-wrenching that you just can't do anything to help your child that you so desperately would love to do something, either, you know, donate a part of yourself or take him somewhere that would give him some miracle operation or some medication or something that would help him, you know, help his issues. But failing that, we've decided, my wife and I, to throw ourselves into our energies behind supporting charities that help children like Carter. And when we started the rink, we chose Easter Seals Newfoundland and Labrador, Rainbow Riders Therapeutic Rutting Newfoundland and Labrador, and Mazel Shriners. And all three of those charities, the reason we picked those charities in particular, were they all have impact on Carter's life, positive impact. So we wanted to give back to the charities that help children like Carter.
And so specifically then, what are the activities that take place on your rink, and you're raising funds for these charities? So what's going on your rink, you know, in recent winters?
Well, I started the very first year, it was kind of, I didn't really know what to expect. So I had one charity hockey game, and I had some people who once became very well known in the media about my rink, became very publicized. People, I was flooded with requests to skate on it and to rent it. So there was a lot of rental requests and things like that. And a lot of requests came from people who had like a regular skating time at an arena, but they wanted to skate outdoors. It was like a winter classic type feel. And that really resonated with people. And the reason I was doing it really resonated with people. So what I do now is starting in the second year, I started doing charity hockey games. And I thought about local teams or local groups here locally that might have an interesting little rivalry. For example, I have one charity hockey game with the Royal Newfoundland Constabulary and the St. John's Regional Fire Department, because the firemen and the policemen have a little rivalry in rec hockey. So they were very, very enthusiastic, and they've been great donors over the years of raising money for my rink. I've had the employees of St. John's and Mount Pearl, are two twin cities here on the East Coast, raise money for me. I was on the Hebron project, ExxonMobil Hebron project, for 6.5 years. And the employees of the Hebron project did a Hebron Cup 5 years in a row and raised over $30,000 in 5 years, which was just tremendous.
And you mentioned that you get people to organizations to sponsor the rink boards and things like that. How much money do you think that you've raised over the years for these children's charities?
Right now, over 5 years, it's been $268,000. And one of the frequent questions I get asked, do I take any of the money to pay for rink maintenance or to build a rink to start with or anything like that? And I can honestly say that 100% of that $268,000 has gone to the charities. Any money for the upkeep or building the rink is strictly been my own money. So what I insist when a donor makes a donation to Reason for the Rink, they make it by check, and they do not make it to Reason for the Rink. They don't make it to Todd Churchill. They pick one of my charities, and they make it directly to the charity.
Todd, you're a remarkable guy with a remarkable rink. Are you going to be doing it again this coming winter?
This winter is going to be difficult because right now my wife and I are in a little bit of a battle with the Department of Education here in Newfoundland and Labrador. As I mentioned earlier, my son is deaf. So unfortunately, the provincial government does not sponsor or to support children who are deaf in the education system very well. For example, last year, my son started kindergarten, and he was only provided 1.5 hours per 7 days with a teacher of the deaf. So, I mean, it's when you're only getting 1.5 hours of quality instruction, the rest of the time you're in a classroom with a teacher that has no way of communicating with you because that teacher doesn't speak ASL, American Sign Language. It's very hard to achieve anything academically. Well, our hopes are that eventually he will be provided with a full-time teacher of the deaf. There used to be a school of the deaf here in Newfoundland, and it closed in 2010. And when it closed, the provincial government of the time made commitments that all students that were currently in the school that were being mainstreamed would continue to receive the same support as they had received in the school of the deaf. And it appears those students did. But new students like my son coming into the system are not being supported in the same way. So we're really pushing to ensure that he receives 100% of support every day with the teacher of the deaf who is qualified to teach. We're like any parent. We just want to have our child in the best position to be successful academically.
As a parent myself, I can appreciate just how important it is to make sure that your kids have access to a good education. So we do wish you well on that front. And I guess I want to wrap up the interview by talking about you've described a lot about, you know, what your rink does for other people, what it does for especially for organizations that help kids and for, you know, the parents of kids like Carter who rely on extra services from the community through the organizations you support. What do you personally get out of this project? Is there something special just for you alone in terms of doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. To me, it's very therapeutic because as I said earlier, like when you have a child like Carter, it gives you such a helpless feeling as a parent that you can't make the problem go away, and it makes you feel so helpless. So I feel this is a way to be proactive and do something, make something good out of something bad, and try to do something proactive to help children like Carter. So in that way, it's very therapeutic. And I find it's a great sense of relaxation. Like most nights on my rink, I don't go outside until probably 10 o'clock at night. And the reason being is I wait for my children to go to bed because I don't want to have a rink where I'm at my rink all the time and I'm not spending time with my children, because if you're doing that, what's the point of it? So usually I don't go out until 9:30, 10 o'clock once they're straightened away in bed. So many nights I'm out there till 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And in the stillness of the night, when it's just me, everybody else has gone to bed, the entire neighborhood's quiet. It's just very, very relaxing. It's a good way to unwind. And I'm not sure it's something I'd recommend to everybody. It's probably not everybody's way of relaxing, but it works for me.
Todd, it's been really interesting chatting to you about your rink. Can you remind us where people can follow the progress of the website, where they can follow the progress of your rink?
Yeah, absolutely. They can follow me on Twitter at Reason for the Rink or on Facebook at Reason for the Rink, or also check out numerous pictures and videos and different things from past seasons on reasonfortherink.com.
And I suspect that, like a lot of people who have been skating on your rink in the past few years, that will be hoping that Carter gets the services that he deserves from the education system so you can get back to business of running that rink of yours.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something I have a tremendous passion for. And, you know, we spent a lot of time at the charities I've mentioned. Just this August, for example, we were at Shriners in Montreal to get some services for Carter. And it's so rewarding when you see other children. The money that goes towards Shriners that I raise is for transportation costs of moving or transporting children like Carter from Newfoundland to mainland hospitals for treatments. And I know they transport over 100 children per year from this province to other hospitals. And it's rewarding to be able to say, you know, I'm helping them do that, because it's quite a mission they fulfill. And with Rainbow Riders, for example, they do therapeutic horseback riding, and that's something Carter does. He's done it for the last 3 years, and it's rewarding every time when he does his riding. He loves it. It's not like a lot of therapy does, where it's not so pleasant for him. It's more hard work. You know, the horseback riding is therapy that's just really enjoyable, and it's great to be able to see him and see all the other children enjoy it so much. And with Easter Seals, he does a whole range of activities like therapeutic swimming. He does sledge hockey, different events like that, and different programs. So it's so rewarding to be able to give back to the charities that are helping out Carter. And we've set up a Facebook group called Equity for Education of the Deaf in Newfoundland and Labrador. So we're looking for anyone with experiences with deaf children in the education system, particularly in Newfoundland, but also in other provinces, so we can get some sort of benchmarking of how other provinces treat deaf students, because it seems like it varies from province to province.
As I said earlier, Todd, you're a remarkable guy. Thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Final conversation in this episode is with an Edina, Minnesota father who built a backyard rink for his son, even though he can't use it because of a genetic condition. You'll find out why Phil Shimke built this backyard rink in our interview that now follows.
My next interview is with Phil Shimke. He is a lifelong hockey player, backyard rink maker, and parent from Edina, Minnesota. Hey, Phil, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by, I think when we were talking earlier, you said that you've been playing hockey since birth. Is that about accurate?
Just about, yeah. When I was growing up in South Minneapolis, my parents made an ice rink, and I'm the last of six kids. So we always had an ice rink from the time I can remember, all the time I can remember. And so I think that's about right.
And I think you Minnesotans are like us Canadians. You love your hockey and your outdoor skating rinks. Is that a good commentary on my part?
Oh, yes. That's definitely true.
Well, listen, you've kept up the family tradition. You have a rink in your backyard. How long have you yourself been building your own rinks?
Now about 12 years. I grew up in Minneapolis, and then we moved away and lived in Seattle for about 7 years and had our kids, and then we moved back to our family about 12 years ago. And when we purchased this house, when I saw the flat rectangular backyard, the first thing I was thinking was ice rink. And so we kind of bought the house because of the flat rectangular backyard in a lot of ways. When I started making the rink, I did it the old-fashioned way, like I did when I was a kid, where you basically just, I think some people call it slushing it, where you just get your garden hose out and you just start making layers. If there's some snow, you just kind of slush it with your boots to build up a little bit of ice and then fill in all the little spots over time, just thin layers. And then over the years, after a couple of years, I started using a plastic liner.
And has the rink been getting more and more elaborate each year in terms of its design, the boards, and things like that?
Just slightly elaborate. I started out with very low. I still have very low boards. I don't really like to call it a hockey rink so much as an ice rink, because I want all the kids in the neighborhood to be able to come out there and have fun and not think it's hockey is the only thing that's important. So yeah, I started out with very low boards. I made my own out of wood. I made these little brackets to hold up a little border, a wood 1x4 border around that perimeter, and then to hold in the plastic. I tried using painter's plastic and taping it together, and that didn't work. And you know, sometimes I thought that using plastic was more hassle than it was worth. But then I finally found a company that would make a giant that sold a very big tarp, and so now I use one of those, and I can use it for about 3 or 4 years before I need to get a new one, before skates and dog claws and things destroy it.
You mentioned that the kids around the neighborhood like to come visit your rink. On a nice sunny day in the middle of January, how many kids might you get out there?
Well, you know, some days it's zero, but then some days it could be 6 or 7 at the most. And but I would say most of the time it's, you know, a couple will come here, 3, and then they'll go, and then maybe an hour later a couple more will come. And what's interesting is I actually converted part of my garage into a warming house, so that makes it you know, nice for the kids to come over.
So can you describe this warming house for us?
Sure. Well, we have a very small house. Small house, big yard, relatively. And it's a one-car garage, and it's really a one-car garage. If you know, if you have stuff, you can't even use it as a car for your car. You just use it for your stuff. So one day my wife was visiting her parents in a close-by city, and I cut a hole in the side of the garage and put up a partition wall about a third of the way through the garage and framed it in and built. And then eventually the first year was just lawn chairs in there, and then I slowly built benches and added posters and memorabilia and old hockey sticks on the walls, and it's still pretty rustic looking, but I kind of like it that way.
You and your wife must have a very strong relationship if she comes home to find that you've cut a hole in the garage wall.
Yeah, well, you know, you know, that put a little strain on it, but not too bad. She knew that how much I loved making the ice rink and how much I loved having the kids over to skate, because it just kind of brought me back to when I was a child. And so, you know, again, it's always good to have a happy spouse, right?
It's better than the alternative, that's for sure. And the reason that you came to our attention when we were putting together this podcast is because we saw an NBC News story about you and your family, and about the fact that this rink is a little extra special for your family and fills an important need in your family's life. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Right before we moved back from Seattle, so we have a son who's now 16, and he was 4 at the time. And we had a daughter who was about a month old. We found out that our son had something called Fragile X syndrome. And it's a developmental disorder that's genetic. And it means he's got a delayed, has a mental impairment. And then a few years later after that, while we were in Minnesota, we found out he was also diagnosed with autism. A lot of the Fragile X kids have autism. So, you know, originally when I was young and when we got married and I had a child and I had a boy, I was very excited about him learning to skate and I guess play hockey too. And we had him on skates. And so, when we found out that he had Fragile X syndrome and autism, it was pretty devastating to us as a family. And we only, and you know, I think at some point, you know, obviously he would go out and skate, but he couldn't really learn to skate. And but what it did was, you know, one of the things that I didn't want to happen was our son to be isolated from kids in the neighborhood. And if you know, winters, they can be very long. And if you don't, a lot of times nowadays with all the electronic games and iPhones and apps and everything, kids don't go outside as much as they did when they were younger because they can just stay inside and play their games. And so we didn't want our son to really get forgotten. And so part of the reason I kept making the rinks, even though he couldn't skate, and my daughter was really, really little, so obviously she couldn't skate, is to bring kids around our house, and so that he, you know, he has a hard time communicating and interacting with other kids, and they would see him, and he could see that there were kids, and they would interact with them, and he would go out in the rink when he saw kids out there, and we would pull him around in the you know, sled and things like that on the rink. And so it just helped to make us less isolated.
And how do you think your son responds to the rink? Like, what, you know, does he get excited about it? Does it have some special meaning to him?
Well, he's nonverbal, and so it's very hard to know, but I think it does. He, for a long time, when he saw me skate out there, he wanted to come out there. And then when he didn't come out there, he would look out the window. We have a kind of it's a room of just all windows facing the rink, which actually can be dangerous, but with pucks and such. But he loves watching kids out there. It's become less so because his autism has, you know, has become, it's just become a little more debilitating, it seems, than it was before. But he still enjoys seeing kids out there, and occasionally when there are kids out there, he will go out there. So otherwise, it's hard to get him outside onto the rink. So, and he loves to see his sister out there and me, and you know, it's just one more thing for us to help bring him out a little bit.
And how about for you personally? I mean, what does the rink provide some sort of therapy for you too? Because I mean, people who have kids who have special needs, it's a different type of lifestyle for them, and there's different stresses than other families might have. You know, does the rink provide you some sort of you know, spiritual or mental benefits?
I think so. I don't, you know, until someone asks you, you don't necessarily think about it that much. It does. It's, you know, when you're outside, I like winter. I like the cold. I like being outside in the cold. And it's, you know, I'm out there flooding at night or shoveling or working on the rink. And it's always been after the kids go to bed, and it's silent, and it's quiet. You know, you can have time to think. And also it's a little bit of a throwback to when I was a kid, and it makes me feel good to know that there are kids who come over and can experience the outdoors in the winter instead of just being inside. Yes, patience. You have to put water on in very thin layers. Always err on the side of putting less water on. You have to do thin coats most of the time. And if you don't have a flat yard, it can be very difficult. My focus has tried to be to not focus so much on hockey, and just to focus on being outdoors and having fun. I notice a lot of people make rinks, they make it a hockey-centric one, and it's elaborate. And, you know, I prefer this more simple simple throwback kind of ice rink with snowbanks that the kids can jump into and play in and make forts. And when it snows, we'll make a pile of snow in the middle, and we'll jump into it. And we've got the dog out there with the pucks playing, and and getting the kids to shovel too. That's actually really good for their skating too. And it's just making it a winter wonderland as opposed to just a hockey centric kind of thing.
Listen, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
That was Phil Shimke. I reached him via Skype at his home in Edina, Minnesota. That just about does it for another episode of Rink Talk. We went a little long today, but I hope you don't mind. I really wanted to make sure we got all three of those interviews into a single episode. There's a common theme that runs through them. It's a theme of hope, the idea that a backyard rink can play a small role in bringing joy and happiness to a family that's experiencing challenges that the rest of us may not experience. I would like to thank all three of my guests. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I'd also like to thank Keenan Reimer Watts, who composed the original music for today's podcast. Keenan was joined by Clarissa Webb in performing it. If you enjoyed what you just heard, please like us on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. It helps. Hope to have you back again for our next episode of Rink Talk. I'm Robert McClemon.